evil's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my rock?
Now the N is for not, or no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish it didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Bukitas, who plays a sour note. W is tie is this, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, April 20th, 2011. The Palestine News Network reports that extremist settlers handed out an eviction notice to 10 families living in Sheikh Jarrah in East Jerusalem on Tuesday. Also on Tuesday, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, PCHR, reported that Abdel Rizik, 52, died in a Gaza prison. He had been arrested on the previous Thursday. His family were informed by the Gazan police that he had died on Tuesday, but the circumstances of the death are not yet known. Israeli sources reported that the police arrested 4 Arab lawyers from the north of the country in recent weeks on suspicion that they delivered messages from detained Islamic Jihad detainees to the movement's representatives in the Gaza Strip and the other way around. On Tuesday, Hamas forces raided a building in an attempt to arrest several suspects. In the murder of Italian activist Vittorio Arrigoni last week. When the suspects shot at the security forces, a shootout ensued, and 2 suspects were killed, according to local sources. In addition, a 3rd suspect was arrested by the Hamas security forces. The 2 suspects who were killed were identified as Abdul Rahman Al-Braizat and Bilal Al-Umari, and the suspect who was arrested was identified as Mahmoud Mohammed Nimer Salfit. Egyptian Al-Ahram newspaper reported that a new European mediator has started mediation talks for the release of prisoner of war Corporal Gilad Shalit, captured by the resistance in Gaza since mid-June 2006. The paper quoted an anonymous Hamas source who refused to declare the nationality of the new mediator, but said that the mediator has, so far, shown fairness, honesty and creativity. Gerhard Konrad was a former mediator in the Shalit talks. The Miles of Smiles 3 humanitarian convoy is preparing to head to the Gaza Strip as preparations and coordination between several international human rights groups and local Palestinian organisations are underway for the 3rd convoy. The convoy will attempt to deliver medical equipment, incubators, stretchers and ambulance equipment, 3 vehicles equipped for transporting persons with special needs, first aid kits and urgently needed medical equipment and medications. Palestinian medical sources in Iraq Burin village, near the northern West Bank city of Nablus, reported on Tuesday evening that one resident was shot and another wounded after a group of extremist Israeli settlers attacked the village and broke into his home. Dozens of armed settlers of the nearby Bracha illegal settlement attacked several homes in the village and fired dozens of rounds of live ammunition. Israeli TV, Channel 2, reported on Tuesday at night that an Australian man of Saudi descent was arrested at Ben Gurion Airport on suspicion that he had intended to spy on Israel on behalf of the Hamas movement. That sums up our news for today. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Centre. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Hussam Khassis and me, David Steele.
Afghanistan, Saturday. 5 U.S. soldiers were killed when an Afghan government soldier suddenly turned on them. One report indicated he hurled grenades. Another report said he used a suicide bomb vest. Afghanistan, Saturday. 3 more NATO occupation soldiers were killed in 2 separate roadside bomb attacks. Baghdad, Sunday. 3 rockets fired from southern Baghdad hit the airport. No information as to damage or casualties at this time. In addition, the Iraqi army discovered a launch pad with rockets aimed at the Green Zone. Baghdad, yesterday, 6 bombs went off in various parts of the city, killing 3 people and wounding 22. Camp Ashraf, Iraq, home of the MEK or People's Mujahideen Iranian Exile Opposition Group. The United Nations confirmed Friday that 34 people were killed by Iraqi government troops. Without the U.S. invasion of Iraq, they would still enjoy the protection the former regime gave them, so the U.S. shares responsibility for this massacre. Washington, D.C., 17th of April. Iranian MEK supporters protested in front of the White House against the massacre of at least 34 MEK members at Camp Ashraf by the U.S.-supported Iraqi government. Nasiriyah, Iraq, Tuesday. A bomb went off near a U.S. convoy in northern Nasiriyah, according to chairman of the Thaikar Council Security Commission. Quote, a bomb exploded on Tuesday targeting a U.S. convoy in Abu Hawala region between Al-Shatra and Al-Nasr districts, northern Nasiriyah, without causing casualties. Sajad al-Assadi told Azwa al-Iraq news agency. Wait a minute! What U.S. convoy? What bomb? I thought U.S. combat operations in Iraq were over! Oh yeah! That's been said before! Mr. Barack Obama, has anything really changed in over 8 years of war? Now's the time to pull the plug! Bring all the troops home from both Iraq and Afghanistan today!
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me, ain't going back again.
Obama, elected with the help of anti-war voters, got an embarrassing surprise this morning, the 21st of April. He was at some kind of Democratic Party fundraiser when protesters suddenly interrupted him, demanding the release of Private First Class Bradley Manning, the accused sender of information to WikiLeaks, and an end to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. They tried to play it off by asking former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi if she had anything to do with it. The answer was no. My guess is code pink, but I won't know for sure till I see a communique. Obama is now being heckled by George W. Bush for continuing George W. Bush's wars.
Generals gathered in their masses.
Psychologist Stephen Reisner is an outspoken critic of those in his profession who participated in coercive interrogations or torture, which he says is defined as treatment that injures a prisoner for the purpose of extracting information. Reisner maintains that torture takes many forms, but that emotional and psychological techniques, such as sleep deprivation, isolation, and humiliation, leave more serious, though invisible, scars than the physical tactics that are usually thought of as torture, such as applying electric shocks or waterboarding. In early April, he appeared in New York District Court to press his complaint against fellow psychologist Army Major John Liso, who Reisner accused of unethical conduct for his role in the torture of prisoners at the U.S. military's Guantanamo Bay Detention Center in Cuba. The complaint accused Liso of recommending the interrogation methods employed against Mohammed al-Qahtani, an alleged 9/11 conspirator, that Reisner says included forced hydration, induced hypothermia, 20-hour interrogations, forced nudity, and religious disgrace. The complaint, which charges Liso of violating New York State professional standards, was supported by the New York Civil Liberties Union and the Center for Justice and Accountability. The Pentagon didn't respond to a request for comment on Reisner's complaint against Major Liso. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Stephen Reisner about torture and what he believes to be the ethical position a psychologist should hold regarding the issue.
I can tell you from having treated torture survivors that the non-physical forms of torture have a much more traumatizing and long-lasting effect than the physical forms of torture. So when you put electrodes on somebody, or you give them a bunch of little cuts, or you beat them up, it's terrible. But they don't have as hard a time being able to talk about having been tortured than when they've been humiliated or have gone crazy or have put in stress positions, which makes them feel that if only they hadn't moved in just this position, it wouldn't have hurt so much and they could have avoided talking. The psychological pressures that lead to people to break, the research shows that they have much longer-lasting scars and effects on people than the physical tortures.
Would you say that since Bradley Manning, the alleged whistleblower in the WikiLeaks case, is kept in isolation 23 hours a day, or any prisoner for that matter, is kept in isolation, that's torture?
Yep.
And the isolation alone, even if no other factors are present, has a really horrible detrimental effect for years afterward?
Not necessarily. That depends on the character of the person. I mean, some people don't get traumatized. There are certain things that we've all decided over the centuries are wrong. And abusing prisoners as punishment or to get information from them is, universally condemned, except at certain periods in time by certain regimes that until the Bush administration, our government joined in condemning.
Stephen Reisner, isn't it true that the American Medical Association and the American Psychiatric Association prohibit their members from being involved in coercive interrogations? What's the difference between these two groups and the American Psychological Association?
The difference is that the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, follow the World Medical Association. They basically say that the role of a health practitioner is to help people and not hurt people. It's based on the basic ethical principle of do no harm. And the American Psychological Association has decided that their people can participate in coercive interrogations whose aim is to cause prisoners to speak against their will. And the American Psychological Association has joined the Justice Department under the Bush administration in, deciding that the same standards that would apply to any interrogator should apply to a psychologist. And that's different than other health professionals. The other health professionals see themselves first as a health professional. The American Psychological Association has created a new category of operational psychologists and have basically joined with the military in, you know, saying that clinical psychologists can be military combatants whose aim is to debilitate the enemy, get information, and use people as if we're at war with them to undermine their mental and physical state if it helps the war effort. The story is that I have brought a ethics case against John Lesso, Major John Lesso, who was one of the health professionals at Guantanamo on the team that created the torture protocols that were used on two detainees very specifically, and in general, just about all the detainees. Some aspects of it were used on all the detainees. He's a clinical psychologist licensed in the state of New York. Unfortunately, the Board of Professional Discipline simply refused to investigate. And so we brought a case in New York State Supreme Court to have the court order the Office of Professional Discipline to open an investigation. And my argument was that a clinical psychologist who uses his psychological expertise, who's hired as a clinical psychologist for the client, which was the military, and is hired to do harm to individuals, is violating the ethical principles of New York psychology, the code that we are all beholden to, in such a way that he should be investigated and his license should be taken away from him if it turns out that, based on the investigation, that this allegation is true.
That was psychologist Stephen Reisner. Find more information on Reisner's torture case against Major John Lesso on our website at btlonline.org.
Suppose Army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the Army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
From the 15th to the 17th of April, protesters deployed to the streets of D.C. against the spring meetings of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank on the anniversary of the great siege of the bank that took place on the 16th of April back in 2000.
Protest mixed with coal protest, power shift pouring into the streets to support it.
It all started the previous day, April 15th, as a small contingent from Jubilee, USA, carried gold bars around the meetings, demanding that the IMF and World Bank spend excess profits from the sales of their gold on canceling debts of poor nations. next morning, militant anti-capitalist protesters hit the streets at 6 a.m. and found themselves confronting IMF delegates at the checkpoint set up for them to enter the meetings outside the IMF's headquarters. They're saying, loan shark, what do you say? How many kids have you killed today? At one point Friday, a fossil shark puppet, a loan shark puppet, circled the World Bank. This was after the march stopped by the Mayflower Hotel, where IMF delegates were staying for a wake-up call.
Right across the Mayflower. Charge!
Right there, a crowd of protesters burst through a line of motorcycle cops, charged across Connecticut Avenue, and reached the doors of the Mayflower, but they were not successful in getting inside. That's been done too many times, and the cops were expecting it. That's the sound of all those delegates to the IMF meetings being blown out of bed by vuvuzela horns and people yelling, World Bank, blood on your hands, at about 7 a.m. Next up was Rainforest Action Network marching out of Power Shift, joined by the same anti-capitalists that went after the IMF meetings in the morning for a joint march on Citibank, PNC Bank, and the IMF and the World Bank. It's a charge against Citibank. Coming in on Citibank. Rainforest Action Network wrapped up Citibank in yellow tape like a police tape, saying global warming crime scene. The breakaway march starting to the World Bank. Way brought hundreds of people to the IMF and World Bank. So the Summer Rainforest Action Network had gone back to the convention center, a lot of Power Shift to join the march.
There's that checkpoint.
Once again, some of the IMF delegates were caught out, trying to get out for lunch or something like that. Their limos were confronted in the streets by protesters. Later that night, IMF protesters returned to Georgetown for the first time in a couple of years, after a second attempt to pay a wake-up call with the Mayflower sale. After 2 days of street action, protests against the IMF and World Bank closed with a festival of resistance in Murrow Park, right across the World Bank, where economist Mark Weisbot had this to say about how effective protests against the IMF and World Bank have been since the great siege of the bank back on April 16th, 2000.
The IMF has lost an enormous amount of the power that it had 11 years ago. And all over Latin America, for instance, in 2003 in Latin America, you had about $57 billion in loans in Latin America. And now you have about $1 billion. And they're not telling any of the left of center governments what to do. And the same is true in middle income countries in Asia, in Russia. So it's been hugely reduced. Now, people don't realize that, I think, partly because there was this big comeback of the IMF since the world recession, right? They tripled their resources. They went from $250 billion to $750 billion. They've never had anything like that before. Most of the middle income countries in the world are completely outside their reach. And in Latin America, that's made a huge difference. I mean, if you look at Bolivia, for example, they renationalized their hydrocarbon resources. And there was something the IMF insisted on them not doing. They were under IMF agreements for 20 years until Evo Morales was elected. In 2005, 2006, he said he wasn't going to renew any agreements with the IMF.
Yeah.
They renationalized their gas, hydrocarbons industry that year, and they've greatly increased spending on social programs, on child nutrition, on pensions, on...
Like Bolivia, more and more nations are now turning on the IMF and World Bank,
supported by global opposition to their policies. The very last act of the Festival of Resistance was a skit dramatizing this as a circus performance, with two people inside a tiger suit that moved very much like a real tiger, which was labeled as symbolizing developing nations. Two tiger trainers in the circus ring were labeled as the IMF and World Bank. And after ordering the tiger to roll over a few times and jump through a hoop labeled Natural Resources, the tiger turned on them, chased them around the ring, and chased them behind the curtain, from which a faint sound of screams was heard. Is that how bacon bits are made? Anyway, speaking of bacon bits, way back in 2000, at the great siege of the bank, there was a banner that said, quote, "Today's pig is tomorrow's bacon," and they weren't talking about hogs with four legs. The IMF and the World Bank are on the menu and on their way out the door. Anywhere in the world, the IMF and World Bank try to set their hooks, people rise up and fight. The Latino nations are throwing them out, and when nations like Greece and Portugal beg for IMF bailouts, people rise up in the streets and fight them with every means at their disposal. Major battles were fought in Greece last year over an IMF bailout. Portugal will be next. And if they think they'll have any respite from Greece and Portugal in Washington, D.C., they've got another thing coming. Every time they come here, the last 11 years, something different happens, and it's never fun for the spring or the fall meetings of the IMF and World Bank. On the 18th of August, as thousands of climate activists march through the streets of D.C., some of them return the jar of BP's oil and tar balls to BP's D.C. headquarters. Huge numbers of marchers in the streets, the march set out from the Chamber of Commerce, raised comparisons to the World Bank protest in 2000. Here it is, the main power ship crew rolling in on BP. BP right there. Genuine BP Macondo oil spill tar balls was left in front of the door of BP's government relations headquarters in D.C. on New York Avenue. Security guards complained that the jar of tar balls was a hazard and couldn't enter the building. But gee, BP, it seems to me you sure didn't consider those tar balls much of a hazard in the Gulf Coast when you were making decisions about how to go about drilling that Macondo well. So BP, don't be surprised when your gushers of oil bring a gusher of protesters to your doorstep. The 18th of April, climate activists under the banner of Reclaim Power stormed the lobby of the Department of the Interior in D.C.
Here it goes! Charge!
Sound from inside the Department of the Interior as the lobby is occupied by opponents of mountaintop removal, coal mining, and other destructive oil, gas, and coal leases that the Department of the Interior approves. Here's what a speaker from Black Mesa, a piece of Native American land being destroyed by Peabody Coal, had to say about the Department of the Interior and extractive industries in the United States.
Hello, greetings to you all. Thank you for all the amazing energy that you bring here today. on this day, this beautiful day, that we are all here and we have the ability to speak out and voice out. In a lot of parts of this world, a lot of people don't have that ability and don't have that freedom to do what we do today as we're taking action today. I work with the Black Mesa Water Coalition, and we're based out of Flagstaff, Arizona. And where I'm from is called Black Mesa, and it's on the Navajo Hopi Reservation. And for the past 10 years, we've been organizing. We started off as young people, just like you, holding our governments accountable, our tribal governments here, the Department of Interior. Actually, one of our first action was right here in 2001. And a couple years ago, I drove by here and I said, well, remember about 8 years ago, we had an action right here. And, you know, now 2 years later, I'm seeing you all, you know, holding our government accountable. And for a lot of us as indigenous peoples, we see these energy policies that Department of Interior, Department of Energy, that is pushing on our indigenous peoples and our communities. These kind of climate solutions, they call it, like carbon capture sequestration. That is not a solution. This is one plan that they tried to push in our communities last year. And then another plan was to do, well, also uranium mining, more uranium mining in the Southwest.
Bigger boom! Super boom!
For the past 50 years, our people have been suffering from uranium mining and radiation exposure. So we know nuclear energy is not clean at all. And the question we need to be asking these federal agencies, where are they going to get their uranium? Not from indigenous people's land, that's for sure, because we are going to... Back in 2001, the way we started our organizing was to protect our groundwater, the Navajo Aquifer. The Office of Surface Mining, which is under the Department of Interior, allowed for over 35 years for Peabody Coal Company to use pristine water to slurry coal, to transport coal through a 300-mile pipeline that fed 5 million homes in the Southwest. At the labor of our people, at the health expense of our communities, and our pristine water, we cannot allow this unsustainable form of energy continue in this country, but also for them to continue to take advantage of communities like mine, who still, a lot of people still speak our Navajo language, who cannot look at an environmental impact statement, an 800-page environmental impact statement. A grandma cannot read that whole document. That is unjust, and that is environmental racism. Big supporters of the transition to clean renewable energy, meaning wind and solar. But also, we need to create this transition plan so it benefits everybody, not just one corporation, not just one arm of an agency. We need a plan that's going to also give back to our communities. Currently, 50% of my people do not have electricity or running water. A lot of our kids still go on the buses every day and travel on dirt roads. This isn't America. So we need to make these connections between the frontline communities. It's not just in Appalachia, it's not just in Black Mesa, it's in the Powder River Basin, it's in Alaska. These are the connections we need to be making worldwide, in Australia, in Bosnia, in Venezuela. There are coal fights happening all over the world.
Yeah.
And how do we build this movement so it's just and that everyone has a voice at the table, not just a few environmental or conservation groups here in D.C. negotiating the future? It needs to be all of us. I just want to encourage you all to continue to learn, and that I also encourage you all to come to our homelands in Black Mesa region, where I feel very, very privileged today to have this opportunity to speak here in D.C. and share a little bit about my life and my community to you all, because Not a lot of people in my community have the opportunity to come here and to say something and to express their concerns. So I just want to say thank you for this opportunity, for everyone who organized this. Two daughters now, and they're so beautiful and they're so precious to me, and I do this for them and I do this for the future generations and their great-great-grandchildren, and that's the way we need to be thinking, and that's the way we need to be planning. The Department of Interior and their energy policies are just another form of genocide to our people as Indigenous people. That train of thought that we must assimilate Indigenous people, Native people.
And how was that?
We have to take away their language. We have to take away their land. We have to take away their water. No! They have a trust responsibility to my community, to my elders, to my ancestors, and to the future generation. If they're going to have these policies being passed, they have to come out to my community and explain what they're doing and have input from my community. I've been a part of this way too long that I just, I get to a point where I'm just so tired. But I just want to say thank you so much for all of your energy. And I encourage you all to continue to move. And next year and the year after, bring your people. Bring your grandma, bring your dad, bring your mom, bring your kids, bring your brothers and sisters. Bring them here because that's the moment that's going to power and make the change.
Out of the hundreds of people who stormed into the lobby at the Department of the Interior opposing oil, coal, and gas leasing on public lands, 21 refused to leave even when threatened with felony charges by the police, and at the end of the protest they were arrested, though I don't know on what charges.
High levels of radiation at Japan's crippled Fukushima nuclear power plant complex is reported to be a major obstacle to regaining control of four of the six reactors there that lost their cooling systems to the tsunami triggered by the devastating March 11th earthquake. U.S.-made robots that recently entered two of the reactor buildings detected levels of radiation so high it prevented workers from being able to make critical repairs to the broken cooling systems. Although the nuclear plant's operator, Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO, has estimated that it could take 6 to 9 months to stop radiation leaks at the four broken reactors of Fukushima, many nuclear experts are skeptical. One major problem is the growing evidence that the reactor pressure vessel at Unit 2 may be cracked and leaking nuclear material. TEPCO has announced plans to pump tens of thousands of metric tons of highly radioactive water out of damaged reactor buildings, which were partially destroyed by hydrogen explosions in the days after the earthquake. Government and utility officials say they will store the radioactive water in waste tanks, an artificial floating island, and U.S. Navy barges. Fishermen from Japan, South Korea, and China have expressed outrage at the pumping of tens of thousands of tons of radioactive water from Fukushima into the ocean in early April. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Harvey Wasserman, senior editor at freepress.org and author of The Last Energy War and Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth AD 2030. Wasserman examines the information known about Japan's nuclear disaster and reassurances from government and the nuclear industry that radiation released from Fukushima presents little or no danger to human health.
There are apparently robots that have been sent in to a couple of the reactors, and the extremely high levels of radiation in there indicate that there's no quick fix here. We know that the government, not only of the United States, but of course, but of Japan and the utility, lied to us. What makes the situation doubly disturbing is that we also know that they don't know what's going on to a full extent. They may know more than we do, but they don't know enough because this is an entirely new situation. You've had six reactors compromised, four of them clearly seriously. A number of spent fuel pools compromised, and we don't know how many and how bad the damage has been done there. Now, radiation levels, according to Kyoto News Service, radiation levels inside reactors 1 and 3 at Fukushima were very, very high. Now, also, it appears that the reactor building number 4 has been flooded and the water is 5 meters high. And then there's 60,000 tons of contaminated water already in units 1 and 3. We don't know what that's going to mean. We do know that there's going to be high levels of radioactive water continuing to go into the ocean. They've been dumping absorbent material. I mean, basically, they're, you know, here we have this global high-tech nuclear power industry, and they're essentially reduced to dumping kitty litter into these flowing pools of water, which are intensely radioactive and will be in the oceans, you know, for eons. And so, I mean, to run through it, units 1 and 2 apparently had hydrogen explosions. We don't know the status of the cores there. They, because they're still super hot, they may still yet have a meltdown at least, it seems to be a possibility, at least 2 of the reactors, which means the fuel, the super hot fuel, could melt through the pressure vessel, could melt through the bottom of the reactor and go into the earth and eventually as a molten ball of radioactive material hit a water table and cause a steam explosion, which would throw huge quantities of radiation into the atmosphere. That's still a possibility at maybe 2, maybe more reactors at Fukushima. We also have 6 and actually 7 spent fuel pools there. At least one of them seems to have been severely compromised with fuel rods exposed to the air, which means that the zirconium cladding will catch fire or did catch fire and throw large quantities of radiation into the atmosphere. So the bottom line, the minimum, it appears, as best I can tell, and, you know, I'm reading as much as I can, we have 2 reactors that are still seriously untamed, to put it that way, and 1 fuel pool also in serious trouble, and that's at a minimum. Either one of those reactor cores and that one spent fuel pool could cause continued huge radiation releases on a par with Chernobyl. And so, you know, they upped the accident rating there to a 7, which is Chernobyl, but the scale doesn't go high enough. I mean, you have 6 reactors that were compromised.
Harvey, when it comes to the options that the Japanese government and the utility have of controlling these 4 out-of-control reactors, are we talking eventually of entombment, putting sand and cement over the top of these things, and what's been described as a sarcophagus that we saw similar action in Chernobyl? Or do they have the option of repairing the cooling systems and getting these things under control in a more kind of orthodox fashion?
We don't know. And it could vary from reactor to reactor. You've got 6 different situations. They don't know. If you have reactors that are still hot and have the potential for melting, you can't cover them in sand and concrete because they're too hot. They have to be cooled. And not until they reach a certain level of non-criticality could we do that. I mean, you know, here we are 25 years later, almost exactly, by the way, on April 26th, out of Chernobyl, and now they can put a sarcophagus. They couldn't have done that, you know, for years and years and years.
Harvey, on one hand, we hear a lot of apologists for the nuclear industry and some scientists in our media talking about how the minimal amounts of radiation that people, you know, outside the evacuation zone in Japan are subjected to are really nothing to be concerned about. And we also hear similar things being said about the amounts of radioactivity from the disaster in Japan that are being detected all across the United States. How can we sort out fact from fiction when it comes to the dangers that we all face from radiation, whether we live, you know, 200 miles away from Fukushima in Japan or whether we live here in the United States?
Well, this is a really serious and inflammatory and complicated question. There is no safe dose of radiation. And anyone who tells you otherwise is either ill-informed or deliberately deceiving you. If it's detectable, it's dangerous. If iodine turns up in any quantity whatsoever in milk, it should not be drunk by anyone because the iodine will cross the into the thyroid and emit beta particles, which are similar to electrons, and damage the tissues. And the only thing that we know for sure is that there has never been found and never will be found a threshold of radiation exposure which can be deemed safe. It's just not available.
That was Harvey Wasserman, senior editor at freepress.org and author of The Last Energy War and Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth AD 2030. Find links to Wasserman's articles and more information on the Fukushima disaster on our website at btlonline.org.
Chocolate City, this is movement music.
Have you heard the news?
Walmart's coming.
Georgia Avenue, uptown, ain't that something?
Something.
Small businesses, shop owners, hearts pumping, cause they know their livelihoods is about to take a thumping.
Something.
See, you can't compete with a superstore who's an importer of slave labors. Craftsmanship, low price to flip to undercut the market, hand over fist.
Walmart
is infamous for the way they behave. Low wage pay, treat the workers like slaves. Employees who try to unionize,
yeah,
soon find themselves in unemployment lines. The way they treat women needs improving. 1.6 million sisters are suing them
for
being paid less than their male equivalent.
On these issues and more,
we can't afford more to be ignorant.
Keep DC Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me.
They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunist out to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
This is the Funkinest Journalist with your three Walmart commandments. Step one, move in and crush competition by underselling. Step two, pay workers nothing and block unionization. Step three, take all that money, put it into the Walton Family Foundation, and turn that into political influence to protect yourself and make even more.
Walmart,
it's not a good fit for Chocolate City.
Let me holler black at you with the skinny. Important that you clearly understand and remember, DC doesn't work with the right wing agenda. The Walton families are big contributors to bigoted representatives and senators. Trent Lott, sinister, Strom Thurmond, similar, Confederate, state loving George Bush ministers. Oversee your plantation mentality, results in black and brown casualties. Statehood opposition for the district has been supported by Walmart's mischief. The D.C. Voting Rights Act was defeated, assisted via Walmart PACs, and now they wanna come here to see their money stack. Stay up on the facts. Chocolate City, don't relax and fight back.
Keep D.C. Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me.
They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunist out to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
Keep DC Walmart free is an emerging activist group of DC residents stepping up to challenge the corporate big box invasion of Chocolate City. Walmart has plans to establish 4 stores in DC by 2012. Walmarts in DC will threaten small businesses, cause loss of more jobs than it will bring to the community, and lower the wage standards for all workers. To find out more and get involved, visit walmartfreedc.org.
Remember that attempt to close the West End Library in 2007? The one where the required public hearing was held on the 5th of July, the day after the fireworks? Well, those fat pigs at East Bank have once again pushed legislation through the city council to let them close the library and build condos on the site, hopefully to include a new library in the end. Here's a sample of our own radio coverage of what happened last time after a second public hearing.
This is Dial Tone for WSQT Radio. Library closing alert. The City Council has passed legislation to sell the West End Library to East Bank, the same corporation that finances development in Georgetown. On Saturday, July 14, 2007, Joe Sternley, Vice President of Acquisition for East Bank, came to speak to the library. He was met with a crowd that had just been pumped up by an energetic rally outside, put together by Empower DC's People's Property Campaign, as well as some friends of the library.
Yes, sir. If indeed East Bank is
does not want to be secret. If East Bank does not want to be secret, then I take that to mean East Bank is for good government. As a member of this community, I insist upon a competitive bidding of ideas for this library site. And
now, with Fenty and the unwelcome spotlight he attracted gone, those fat slugs at East Bank think they can force the community to accept the closure of yet another library. Some community groups have given up and are settling for attempts to get concessions out of the deal. How about East Bank paying taxes to the city in excess of all that taxpayer money they will get to tear down a perfectly good library so they can sell condos for profit? How about we kick the rich off welfare and keep our libraries open?